So this is the first of two lectures on the capital asset pricing model. And perhaps the first thing I should say up front is don't fall into the trap ever of referring to it as the CAPM, because if you call it the CAPM, the person or people you're talking to will strongly suspect you don't know what it is you're talking about. We either call it the capital asset pricing model in full, or we call it the CAPM, the CAPM for short. The capital asset pricing model is the only pricing model that we will consider in this module. However, it is not the only pricing model in finance. We only have time to introduce one such pricing module, model in this module, and this is our one, the CAPM. Now, can I just remind you of where we've got to in the story so far? We've introduced risk. I hope we're beginning to develop a feel for what is meant by risk. The holy grail for us is our rule for pricing risky assets, and the capital asset pricing model is going to be that rule. But so far in the story, what we've looked at is from the point of view of a single investor. We've learned that our investors are typically rational and risk-averse, or if you prefer, greedy and fearful. So they would like to maximise the return on their investments. So they'd like to have as high an expected return as they could possibly manage. That's because they're greedy or rational. But at the same time, they'd like to have as little risk as possible because they're risk-averse. And we cannot do both. We can't go as far as is possible with maximising expected return and at the same time minimising risk. So a trade-off is involved. And we're going to learn more about how to manage that trade-off in this lecture and Wednesday's lecture. But we've already got clear in our mind that our investors wish to reduce risk where they possibly can. And the technique that we've learned for doing that is called diversification. So having introduced the concept of risk, having established that what we want to be able to do is price or value risky assets, we've also learned that what we need to do is build portfolios of assets. Building a portfolio of assets is using the technique of diversification to reduce risk. So far, so good. But all of that has been from the point of view of a single investor. What we have to do this week in taking the story further is to introduce the idea of there being many such investors, and in particular, to introduce the idea that these investors can trade with one another. Trading means buying or selling these risky assets. And indeed, it's the trading activity that determines the price of the individual assets. So the generalization this week is to move from one investor to a large number of investors. And I've got a name for that large number of investors. I call it the market. So this week brings this additional fundamental concept of a financial market, which is where these individual risky assets are being traded. It's where they're being bought and sold, and it's the aggregate demand and the aggregate supply of these individual assets that determines their price. That's what we've got to work up to then in the course of this lecture and Wednesday's lecture. Now, some of the concepts that I introduced to you, I keep saying them over and over again, and that's deliberate because I don't expect you to understand everything I tell you first time. The first time I mention a particular concept, I may only tell you part of the story because I think that's all that we can cope with at that stage. So it's no accident that we seem to be mentioning some things again and again. My hope is that when we mention them again and again, we add to the story. So we're building on our understanding. I'm claiming that we now have some notion of what's meant by risk. But have you picked up from me that only some forms of risk matter when it comes to pricing assets. Have you picked up that part of the story? Because if you haven't, can I take you back to a diagram in an earlier lecture? Let's have a quick sketch to remind us of something. And if you can draw it before I get it finished, so much the better. Can I remind you of a diagram we had? Just give the visualizer a minute to wake up, in case it's not feeling too well. The diagram I want to draw, once that visualizer has woken up, is the diagram that plots variance of returns on an equally weighted portfolio where the variance of returns on an individual asset is the same, we called it little v, and where the covariance between the returns on any pair of assets, let's see what's happening here, I think that somebody's altered this setup. Does that look better or not? Not convinced that that's picking up what I want it to do. That's what's wrong. Somebody altered the angle. There's just no end to the number of variables that can change in a lecture theatre in this university, at least. There's no end as far as I can see it. So there's my axes, at least would be my axes once I've finished graphing them. So, number of assets in an equally weighted portfolio. This was naive diversification along the horizontal. Variance of returns on that portfolio up the vertical. If we invested all of our money in one such asset, so the trivial portfolio, which is 100% invested in one asset, the variance would be V. If instead we were to spread our wealth very, very thinly across a very large number of assets, then what we saw was that the variance of returns on our portfolio decreased. That's diversification at work. But the variance of returns on the portfolio does not fall away entirely to zero. When I look at that diagram, what it reminds me of is that for any given portfolio, there are two components to the risk. There is this component, which in this simple setup was equal to C. More generally, I'm going to call that systematic or non-diversifiable risk. The second component I might call diversifiable or idiosyncratic risk. The important point is that by taking more and more assets in my portfolio, I can reduce the diversifiable component of risk. I can't do anything about the systematic component of risk. It's only the systematic component of risk that the market, we're just beginning to introduce into the story, it's only the systematic component of risk, this piece, that the markets will reward with additional return. Financial markets take the view that you, yourself, can do something about the diversifiable component of risk. There's no reward for exposing yourself to diversifiable risk. You yourself can do something about that. You can reduce it by spreading your wealth across a larger number of assets, or moving away from naive diversification in the direction of efficient diversification by thinking harder about precisely which assets you take in your portfolio. One of the points I hope we learned from last week is that we can do better at reducing risk if we take the time and trouble to choose our assets so that the correlation between the returns on pairs of assets is low. The lower is the correlation, the greater is the scope for diversification. So the financial markets take the view that this component of risk is not to be rewarded with additional return. It's only the so-called systematic or non-diversifiable component of risk that's rewarded. So keep in your mind for the rest of this lecture, and indeed for all of Wednesday's lecture, we are headed in the direction of a pricing rule. The way in which we're going to write that pricing rule, because it's easier to write it this way, is in terms of how expected rate of return depends on risk. And what we are anticipating is that the greater the risk, the greater is the level of expected return. But there's an important caveat that this little diagram is reminding us of. It's only systematic risk that gets rewarded with extra expected return. So in our pricing rule, in our capital asset pricing model, we are going to come across a measure of systematic risk. And that's all that matters when it comes to deciding what rate of return should we expect on this asset. So let's go back to the type slide. That summarises pretty much what's on that slide. So let's have some maths, I'm afraid. Let's have some maths. In general, we have a portfolio made up out of N risky assets, and you need to be able to write down the expression for the variance of returns on that portfolio. Here is it written, here it is, written in about as concise a form as I can do it. If that in any way scares you, you should step back and ask yourself, okay, what does it look like when N is 2? Let's look at the simplest case where my portfolio is made up only of 2 risky assets. What is actually going on here? What's going on in the case of N equals 2 is there are 4 terms in this double summation. For each of the 2 risky assets, we pick up a variance term. And that variance term, be it sigma 1 squared for the first asset or sigma 2 squared for the second asset, is multiplied by the square of the weight, W1 squared or W2 squared for asset 1 or asset 2. That takes care of 2 of the 4 terms in this double summation. The other 2 terms, the cross terms if I can call it that, they're equal. They're equal because the covariance between asset 1 and asset 2 is the same as the covariance between asset 2 and asset 1. And in each case, that covariance is multiplied by the product of the weights, W1 times W2. So in the simplest case where big N is 2, this double summation equals the sum of 4 terms, 2 variances and 2 covariances. In general, whether we stick to N equals 2, if that makes our life easier, or we keep things perfectly general with big N assets, we can rewrite this double summation like so. Now what I'm doing is I'm pulling out the weight of each asset in turn. So this outer summation is adding up terms starting with asset 1, then asset 2, all the way up to asset N. What's true about each of these terms? Answer, the weight of that particular asset in the portfolio appears multiplied by a whole series of terms. Now it's what's inside the square brackets, it's this whole series of terms that I'm interested in. I want to have a better understanding of what that sum of terms represents. So here, I've spelt it out. What I want you to recognise is going on is I'm picking up a term for each possible covariance. So for a given asset, let's start with asset 1. So little I is 1. So this is the weight of asset 1 in the portfolio. That weight is multiplying a sum of N terms. Each of those N terms brings in a covariance. A covariance of asset 1 with itself. The covariance of asset 1 with asset 2. The covariance of asset 1 with asset 3. Blah, blah, blah. All the way out to the covariance of asset 1 with asset N. And each of these covariances is itself being multiplied by the weight in the portfolio of the other asset. It's either asset 1 or asset 2, blah, 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 all the way to asset N. So what interpretation can I give to this expression in the square brackets? And the clue is down here. The expression in the square brackets is the covariance between the returns on a given asset, asset I in general, or if you want to start with I equals 1, asset 1, it's the covariance between the returns on that particular asset and the returns on the whole portfolio. So what is coming out of the mathematics is the following very important insight. That ultimately what is controlling the variance of returns on the portfolio as a whole is actually a set of covariances. It's the covariance between each of the individual assets and the portfolio as a whole, I'm calling that portfolio P, that matters. Now, where that's going to take on a life and an importance of its own is in a couple of slides' time when I encourage you to start thinking about the portfolio as the set of all risky assets in the market, the so-called market portfolio. So the insight we're starting to get from this slide, it may not have been apparent from the mathematics itself, but the insight we're starting to gain from this slide is what controls the overall level of risk is the covariance between the returns on each asset and the ensemble, the portfolio as a whole. We'll come back to that. We'll make a lot of use of that result. You need to be able to write down this expression, we've seen it before, for the variance of returns on a portfolio of N assets, and you also need to be able to do this manipulation. I could ask you to demonstrate to me that really what matters is covariance between the returns on each asset and the returns on the portfolio as a whole. So I expect you can do that rewriting, and I expect that you can interpret the sum of terms inside the square brackets itself as a covariance. Now, we saw in the very first seminar, when we were calculating variances and covariances, variances of returns on individual assets and covariances between pairs of assets, we saw in that very first seminar that there was a limit to what we could do with numbers like variances and covariances because it was difficult to attach meaning to how big the value was. So there was a need for a scaling, and that's what brought in the concept of correlation coefficient. Well, it's a similar trick again. I'm going to be working in this lecture and in Wednesday's lecture repeatedly with covariances, but it's more useful to me if I scale those covariances. So now I'm going to introduce you to one of the most important numbers in the whole of finance, the so-called beta. And here is the definition of beta. Now we're going to start with a simple definition, which I'm then going to generalise, and it's the general definition that we're going to work with. So my definition of beta, now what do I mean here? This is beta between an individual asset in the portfolio and the portfolio as a whole. The beta of that asset with respect to portfolio P is the corresponding covariance scaled by, divided by, the variance of returns on the portfolio. That's my definition of beta. What beta is doing is giving us a measure of how much risk does asset I, the individual asset, contribute to the portfolio as a whole. That's what beta is doing. That beta is going to turn out to play a crucial role in the capital asset pricing model. At least, it's going to play a crucial role once I've persuaded you now to generalise this definition to the case where big P is the portfolio made up out of all possible risky assets, the so-called market portfolio. And you will know when I'm talking about the market portfolio because I'll always label it big M. Let's look at an example. So I want you to imagine an economy where there are only two risky assets. So if you like, big N is two. And here are the properties of those two risky assets. Here are the risk characteristics of those two risky assets. Now what I am hoping is that when you look at the first bullet point on this slide, you think variance-covariance matrix. I'm hoping that what you are doing mentally is not just reading from left to right, but I hope you're assembling in your mind a 2x2 matrix that has, as its entry in the first row, first column, point 3, because that's the variance of returns on asset 1, that has as its entry in the second row, second column, 0.4, because that's the variance of returns on asset 2, and has in the off-diagonal entries 0.2, so that's in row 1, column 2, and row 2, column 1. That's what I really want you to have in your mind. A 2x2 matrix, as I read it, row by row, goes 0.3, 0.2, 0.2, 0.4. That's the variance-covariance matrix in this case. Now I've got to be a bit clearer about the role that each of these two risky assets plays in the economy. So I'm going to say to you that if the different units of asset 1 and asset 2 that were available for purchase, if they were all lumped together in a single so-called market portfolio, the composition of that portfolio would be as follows. It would be 30% made up of asset 1 and 70% made up of asset 2. That's by value. So the contribution of all the units of asset 1 to the overall value of the market portfolio is 30%. The contribution of asset 2 is 70%. The two weights must add up to 100%, or if we express them in decimals, they must add up to 1. We've seen that before. So now you know the composition of the market portfolio. That's the complete ensemble. The variance of returns on this market portfolio? Well, the variance of returns on any portfolio is given by this double summation. You might want to change in your notes big N. You might want to replace big N by 2, because N equals 2 in this simple case. So there's a double summation. There are 4 terms in all, but 2 of them are equal to one another. So here is the result for the variance of returns on a portfolio of 2 assets, asset 1 and asset 2, where the weights are W1 and W2. We know everything we need to know about this market portfolio. We know the two weights, W1 is 0.3, W2 is 0.7. We know the variance of returns on asset 1, the variance of returns on asset 2, and the covariance between the returns on asset 1 and asset 2. So we can work out the variance of returns on the market. And the answer is 0.307. That's a measure of how risky the market as a whole is. That's what that number represents. What we would like to understand better is how much of that risk is associated with asset 1 and how much is associated with asset 2. What are the relative contributions? Now, what we already know from the earlier slide, it just looked a bit formal because it was the general case. What we know we have to do is look at the covariance between the return on asset 1 and the complete ensemble, which I'm now calling M, and similarly, the covariance between the return on asset 2 and the whole ensemble, which again I'm calling M. And that's what's going on here at the foot of the slide. So this is the covariance between asset 1 and the market. Notice how I'm working it out. Look back to the earlier slide if you've forgotten. 0.23. And similarly, the covariance between the returns on asset 2 and the market as a whole is 0.34. Now, you need to be clear why we're interested in the covariance between the returns on asset 1 and the market, and similarly, the covariance between the returns on asset 2 and the market. But you also have to remember and understand why this is how you calculate that covariance. You look back at the earlier slide if you're not sure or if you've forgotten already. I just don't have a great feel for these two numbers, 0.23 and 0.34. What's more useful to me is to work out the corresponding beta. So go back to the definition of beta. The beta scales the covariance by the overall variance of the market. Now the portfolio I'm talking about is the market portfolio, because in this simple example, there are only 2 assets in the economy, asset 1 and asset 2. So here are our definitions of beta for asset 1 and asset 2. If you want the full name, it's beta of asset 1 with respect to the market portfolio. It's beta of asset 2 with respect to the market portfolio. That's such a mouthful, and it's always clear from the context that we mean with respect to the market that we don't say that. So we just talk about this being beta 1 and beta 2. So each of the two risky assets has a beta. What is that value of beta? Answer, it's given by this ratio. The corresponding covariance with the market divided by the variance of returns on the market. So now I have a number. A number that I can give additional meaning to. So in the case of asset 1, it's approximately 0.75. And in the case of asset 2, it's approximately 1.11. What use can I make of these numbers? Well, now I can start to talk about which of the two assets is riskier. But before I say which of the two it is, and of course it's clear from the numbers, I want you to remember that it's only non-diversifiable risk that's rewarded by the market. Remember the diagram from the case of naive diversification, where by spreading our wealth more and more thinly across a larger and larger number of assets, we could reduce the overall level of risk. We could reduce the variance of returns. But we couldn't push it all the way down to zero. The floor was determined by, yep, the average level of covariance, little c. It's that component of risk that we're interested in. And it's that component of risk, the non-diversifiable risk, that beta is measuring. So when I look at these two values of beta, and I say to you rather glibly, in some sense, asset 2 is riskier than asset 1, I mean in terms of the component of risk that the market is expected to reward with additional return. In other words, the non-diversifiable risk. And that's what we need for our pricing rule. So beta is going to play a fundamental, a key role in the pricing rule that we're going to work up to. As a check that it all hangs together, convince yourself that the beta of the market with respect to the market, i.e. the beta of the market with respect to itself, has to be 1. Convince yourself of that. Just take the weighted average, you know the weights. Asset 1 has a weight of 0.3, asset 2 has a weight of 0.7. Take that particular weighted average of these two numbers and convince yourself that the overall beta of the market with respect to itself has to be 1. It could never be any other way. If there are economists sitting in the room, they might be thinking of this in a different way. They might be looking at what's on the slide and thinking to themselves, and quite rightly so, this beta is nothing other than an elasticity. That's what this beta is. What this beta is measuring is the sensitivity in the returns on a particular asset relative to the market as a whole. Let me be more precise. If the return on the market were to increase by 1%, by how much on average, I'm not saying in any one particular instance, but were we to study things again and again and again, if the rate of return on the market were to increase by 1%, by how much on average would the rate of return on a particular asset be expected to increase? And the answer is beta percent. So where the asset has a beta of approximately 0.75, what we're saying is, on average, for every percentage change in the return on the market as a whole, be that up or down, the rate of return on asset 1 is about 3/4 of that. So it's not exhibiting as much variability as the market as a whole, at least in terms of the component of risk that matters when it comes to pricing these assets. Whereas asset 2, on average, for every percent increase or decrease in the return on the market, asset 2 is expected to increase or decrease on average by 1.11%. So it's exhibiting greater variability than the market as a whole. So in that sense, asset 2 is riskier than asset 1. And we should be thinking ahead and anticipating then that the market that prices each of these two assets will provide a greater rate of return on asset 2 than on asset 1. But we won't know that until we get to the capital asset pricing model. The capital asset pricing model we now anticipate will do that for us. We just have to wait to see that happen. So let's now try to bring it all together. We're building on what we learned last week about forming, constructing portfolios of risky assets. The only difference last week is in terms of how I explained it to you, how I illustrated it. To make our life easier, we focused on the case of two risky assets. And what we saw very early on was that the key parameter was the correlation coefficient between the returns on the two assets, and we looked at different situations. We looked at how the expected return and the variance of returns on the portfolio, what values were possible when the correlation coefficient was exactly plus one, when it was exactly minus one, and most interestingly, because it's the usual situation, when the correlation coefficient was somewhere between minus one and plus one. A problem with everything we did last week is it was restricted to two risky assets, and there is a detail that I have to make sure you are alert to. So let's be clear about it. Let's go forward to this slide so I can point at this diagram. And one of the things that's a good idea to do in finance is always check the variables that are plotted on the two axes whenever you're looking at a graph. And that's never more true than in this pair of lectures this week. We need to be alert to whenever along the horizontal axis we're plotting sigma, that's total risk, and when instead we're plotting beta, which measures the component of risk that can't be diversified away. So let's be clear about the axes. So this is a measure of risk along the horizontal. This is a measure of expected return. I want you to begin with to focus in on this part of the diagram. This particular curve that joins a point labelled A with a point labelled B. That's just like the story we had last week, where we were looking at combinations of two particular risky assets labelled A and B. So the fact that I've joined them up with a curve that bends to the left tells me, I'm assuming, the correlation coefficient between the returns on asset A and the returns on asset B is a number somewhere between plus one and minus one. It's not exactly plus one, it's not exactly minus one, it's the usual situation. So this individual curve is just like the curve we had in our diagrams last week. The only difference now is there are more than two risky assets. In fact, there's lots more. So let's pick another two such risky assets, which I've labelled C and D. And again, you can think about forming portfolios from those two assets only. And again, assuming the correlation coefficient is a number between minus one and plus one, that set of portfolios again is going to describe a curve which again inclines towards the left in the direction of decreasing risk. The story gets more interesting now, because now you can take combinations of any portfolio on this curve with any portfolio on this curve. And that's what this third curve is describing. This curve represents the set of possible combinations of this particular portfolio, which is on the AB curve, and this particular portfolio, which is on the CD curve. Now, as you change the combination of A and B that you're using, so you are positioned at a different point on this curve. As you change the combination of C and D, so you are at another point on this curve. Again, you're combining some combination of A and B with some combination of C and D to generate another of these curves. The more and more assets there are in the universe, in the economy, the more and more ways in which you can do this. What I want you to observe, okay, it's hand-waving. I'm trying to spare you some of the maths, which I'd rather you were spared. What I want you to see we achieve by now taking, say, four assets into the story rather than two, is we can move further to the left. This curve is starting to push the story further to the left. If there are a large number of assets, we can put together any combination of those assets we wish, and we can basically situate ourselves anywhere inside this region. What the mathematics tells us is there's still a limit to how far we can push it, and that limit overall is given by the solid curve. Now, the solid curve represents the so-called envelope of all the possible curves that sit inside. So the new feature that has appeared this week, when we're no longer restricting ourselves to two risky assets, is we no longer have to sit on one particular curve. Now we can occupy a whole area in the diagram. And that area is enclosed by this curve. Now we need to remind ourselves about our investors. They're rational risk averse. Rational risk averse investors like to situate themselves as far as they can in a northwesterly direction. They like to be higher up in the diagram than lower, because that implies greater rates of return, but they like to be further to the left in the diagram, because that implies less risk. And what I'm saying to you is, when there are a large number of risky assets to choose from, this solid curve describes the very best set of possibilities. Anything inside the region enclosed by the curve is inferior. It doesn't manage the trade-off between wishing to maximize expected return and at the same time minimize risk. So the best possibilities sit somewhere on that curve. Now we've got to try and understand, okay, how do we decide where in particular we sit? Let's see if I can do better with the visualizer. So the first thing I'm going to do is try and replicate that diagram on the type slide. So up the vertical axis is the expected rate of return, and along the horizontal is the standard deviation of returns. And that solid curve is that. So that's my attempt to reproduce that diagram. And what I'm saying is, the optimum trade-off between wanting to have as great a rate of return as you can have, but as low an exposure to risk as you can possibly have, that optimum trade-off is represented by the set of points that make up this curve. And that curve as a whole is known as the minimum variance frontier. And I hope now you can see why. Because for a given level of expected return, what the single point on that curve represents is the portfolio with minimum variance. Now, the sharp-eyed amongst you will immediately be thinking, there's something not quite right about this, because he's told us that our investors are rational and risk-averse. I can't begin to understand why anyone would ever situate themselves down here when they could situate themselves instead up here. And that's true. That's absolutely true, all other things being equal. So the next point I have to tell you is, the upper half of this curve is known as the efficient frontier, because it's true. For every point, and every point represents a portfolio, for every point on the lower half of the curve, there is a mirror image on the upper half, same level of risk, but obviously greater level of expected return, which therefore dominates. The mathematicians in the audience who want to know absolutely everything about everything might be interested to know the curve is a hyperbola. What I want to understand is, how does the investor decide where to sit on the curve? And that's where we have to do a bit of economics. So the economists in the audience, they now have the advantage on the rest of us, because we've mentioned something called utility of wealth. And what we've learned already in the story is, what our investors wish to do is maximise their expected utility of future wealth. Now, in terms of the diagram, it turns out there's a whole set of points that give rise to the same value for expected utility. It's a bit like a contour in a map. That contour is typically shaped like that. There's a whole set of them. The economists in the audience will know that these contours describe what are known as indifference curves. So our individual investor is equally happy, or expects to be equally happy, anywhere on this in the indifference curve. He's happier, however, if he can sit on this indifference curve, because that's moving in a northwesterly direction. And indeed, he's getting happier and happier the further he can push the story in the northwesterly direction. There's just one little problem. This is as far as he can go, because this whole area is off limits to him. How do I know that? Because that's what this curve is telling us. The curve represents the envelope of possibilities. So this investor will position himself here. And that point, that particular portfolio of the different risky assets in the economy, reflects that individual investor's risk preferences, the trade-off between wanting to have as big an expected return as possible for as low a level of risk as possible. Whereas a second investor, his indifference curves may look like this. Again, that individual is happier the further he or she can situate himself or herself in a northwesterly direction. And again, as in the previous case, there is a limit to how far the investor can do that. That limit is represented by the corresponding point on the solid curve. The question is, why do the two investors move in different directions? And the answer is because they have different risk preferences. What you've got to ask yourself is, which of the two investors is more risk-averse? You might need to do a bit of maths, or maybe you can just wave your hands. You need to be able to convince yourself that this investor is the more risk-averse. And that's why the point on the curve that that investor settles on has a lower level of risk than the point on the curve that the second investor settles on. So it's the set of risk preferences that decide, if you like, the orientation of these indifference curves. Each investor wants to situate himself or herself on the indifference curve that's as far as possible in the northwesterly direction as he or she can. But they move in slightly different directions because they don't have the same risk preferences. This guy is more risk averse than the other one. So this is more risk averse. This is less risk averse. If we focus our attention on the upper half of the curve, the so-called efficient frontier, I hope what you see emerging is, in order to achieve a higher rate of return, the investor has to expose himself to greater risk. So that's consistent with what we've said in the past. Okay. Now we want to pick up the story from last week in search of this so-called tangency portfolio. Because what we also learned last week, is if there is also the possibility of lending or borrowing at the risk-free rate, it doesn't matter where on the efficient frontier individual investors would position themselves, they're all going to agree on one particular portfolio, namely the tangency portfolio. They're all going to agree that the smartest thing to do with their money is to put some of it in the tangency portfolio with the balance in the risk-free asset. Now, what I want you to appreciate here is the introduction of the risk-free asset opens up greater possibilities than are possible when there isn't a risk-free asset. If there weren't a risk-free asset, the best that our investors can do is position themselves somewhere on this minimum variance frontier, more precisely, somewhere on the upper half, the so-called efficient frontier. But the minute we introduce the possibility of lending or borrowing at the risk-free rate, two things happen. Provided the lending and borrowing rates are the same, everyone agrees that there is a unique portfolio of risky assets that they should use. And secondly, by positioning themselves somewhere on this straight line, now this straight line joins up the point representing the risk-free asset with this so-called tangency portfolio, by positioning themselves somewhere on this straight line, they are able to do better than they could have done by positioning themselves on the upper half of the efficient frontier. I want you to convince yourself that for each point on this efficient frontier, there is a corresponding point on the straight line, and it's higher up. So for the same level of risk, they can achieve a greater rate of return. So there's no argument here that the best thing to do is position yourself somewhere on this straight line. Where you position yourself on that straight line, as we saw last week, depends on your individual risk preferences. But provided the rate of riskless lending and the rate of riskless borrowing are the same, everyone agrees on where this so-called tangency portfolio is. And I just need to remind you, how do we find the tangency portfolio? I need to remind you of the rules of the game. And the rules of the game that I gave you last week were, I will never ask you to prove the results that are on this slide, or indeed were on the corresponding slide in last week's lecture. The only difference being in last week's lecture, we had limited ourselves to two risky assets, so big N is two. I'll never ask you to prove it, but I will assume you can write down what's on this slide. In other words, I will assume that you can write down the equation we need. Now, some of my typing has gone a bit awry with this particular version of PowerPoint, but you've got the correct symbols in your notes. So what is the general result? The general result is portfolio T maximizes the expected Sharpe ratio. Expected Sharpe ratio, what was that? The expected Sharpe ratio is the slope of this line. That's given by this expression. There it is expanded in terms of the individual expected return and variance covariances for the different assets, together with their weights. The weights must always add up to one. What you need to remember, what you need to be able to write down, is the following equation. You need to be able to obtain the weights in the tangency portfolio. Now, if you're wondering what's gone funny with this slide, I'll tell you what it is. This implementation of PowerPoint doesn't like ellipses. It doesn't like dot, dot, dot. So there was an equation or two in an earlier lecture where this symbol K appeared out of nowhere. In the original, it says dot, 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 dot. So there are no lambdas and m's there. These are just dot, 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 so ignore them. What we're trying to do is determine the composition of the tangency portfolio. In other words, solve for the weights of each of the risky assets in the tangency portfolio. And the equation you have to solve when written in matrix form is as follows. This column of weights, this vector of weights, is multiplied on the left by your old friend, the variance-covariance matrix. On the right-hand side are each of the excess expected returns. Excess means the expected return on each asset, 1, 2, blah, 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 all the way down to N, the expected rate of return over and above the risk-free rate. So what you're solving for are these individual weights, but you've got to make sure they add up to 1, and that's why there's a number, a multiplier out here called lambda. The job of lambda is to make sure that the weights you solve for all add up to 1. And that's where we'll take the story further on Wednesday.